What we've been trying to do over the course of the week is examine leadership in a variety of different ways so that hopefully by the end of the week you can arrive at a working definition for yourself and maybe some tools to work with if you're in a leadership role or you're in an organization that might be dealing with leadership issues. You can understand a little bit more about what's happening and perhaps be a more effective contributor in that environment. I proposed on Monday a definition that I took from Joe Rost, and I'll just share it with you and we'll come back to it again. But I would argue that Rost has really started to put the right pieces together in a definition that might hold up. First is that he says leadership is an influence relationship, and this matter of influence has to do with power and how one uses power, whether one uses power in a coercive way or a persuasive way. And so the first thing he says, it's an influence relationship. It is a relationship of persuasion. So that's the first dynamic of leadership. The second is that leadership is a relationship among leaders and followers, and that the place where leadership occurs is here. That's the place where leadership occurs. It's not in this person who might hold a title, and it isn't in the body of people who are working together but might not have a sense of direction. It is the influence of these two upon each other. The third dynamic is that leadership involves intentional change. That if you're not trying to change something, then there's really no need for leadership. Maybe there's need for management, but there's no need for leadership. So leadership will only occur when your organization, whatever it might be, decides that it needs to change, and that the change needs to be real. All right? It needs to be substantive change. And then finally, that leadership occurs when the changes that are worked on reflect mutual purposes. Leaders can get way off track and think they need to go somewhere, the organization needs to go somewhere, and everybody else is sitting here saying, I don't know what's going on over there, but this is not what we want. And so it has to be and can only occur when the person in the leadership role and the group of people in the organization have mutual purposes. Now, sometimes a leader has information and has an understanding and perhaps insight into the organization that people within the organization may not have themselves, because they may not have all the information. And not having the information means that they might not understand what is happening overall and where an organization might need to go. So the leader's got a real challenge in trying to educate people in the organization and persuade them so that the purposes become mutual. Okay, so that's just a reminder of that definition. We might come back to it today. We certainly will come back to it tomorrow. We talked about the traits leaders have. We talk about what transformational leadership is. We used Ernest Shackleton earlier in the week. Yesterday, we talked about the holding environment. If you just came from Michael Pollett's Bible study, actually, I think the holding environment is the into. That is, you're kind of suspended on your way into some new thing. And Paul says, you know, we're kind of there, and we're suspended on our way to Jesus Christ. So that was his analogy in the Bible study today. And I think we could argue that real adaptive change in an organization comes if the leader can figure out how to get the people into that into. We want to go there. We don't know how we're going to get there. We're going to stay right here and have it at hand and figure out how to get in. And we're going to do it together. Okay, so today I've proposed to offer you some tools. And it doesn't matter whether you are in a role of authority in an organization, that is, that you might have a job description that says you're the boss of something, or you're a person in the organization that people have a lot of respect for and who, when you speak, people actually listen and respond to you, or you're in an organization where you see something's got to change, and you want to try to figure out how to work with other people alongside you to get there. One way or another, every one of you in some setting, whether it's in your school, your church, an organization you volunteer in, your corporation, or your family, you deal with, wrestle with problems, and you're trying to move, in many cases, toward change. So today, I'm just going to offer a construct for you, some tools that you might use when you have a problem. And today's book I'll commend to you is a book by Lee Bowman and Terry Deal called Reframing Organizations, Artistry, Choice, and Leadership. This book, I think, was published first in the late 1990s. It's now in its fifth edition and continues to evolve. It's from my perspective, I have been using this book in my work for 10 years. And every time I open it up, there's something fresh that comes in a way of thinking about the organization that I'm in and I'm working in. So I'll commend this to you and encourage you, if you have an interest, it's over in the bookstore.
Who are the authors again?
It's Bowman, B-O-L-M-A-N, and Deal, D-E-A-L. There were at least a half a dozen copies over in the bookstore when I got here last Saturday, so might be worth checking out. Okay, so you have a problem. You have a problem. And today I'd like you to think about what that problem is. All right? Think about your organization. Think about your church. Think about your school. Think about that area of your life where you are involved with a group of other people and you know that something needs to change. Okay? Got that place? And the change that you would like to have happen is a change in beliefs or values. In this group of people that are together, you believe something, and somebody else believes something else. And so there are two values operating there, and they're causing some friction, conflict. That's one structure. Or there's a gap between, people might share values. There's a gap between the values that are being held in the organization and where you think you need to end up. Okay? So just take a second, test your problem against that construct. Does your problem fit there? Does it fit there? Okay, what I'd like you to do with a person by you is to, if you're comfortable doing so, is to talk a little bit about, without getting into the specifics, a little bit in general terms about the problem. And describe it to your partner so you can kind of work through that issue. What is the problem? What values are competing, or what values are held, and where do you think the organization might need to go? So just take a couple minutes and have a conversation with your partner. Okay, let's go. What I'd like to do now is just take a couple of examples that we can use just to get everybody thinking. So if somebody might share just a little bit about, if they're comfortable doing it, and going under the microscope for a little bit here, one situation, all right? Just let's have one example. Somebody want to go?
An organization that fires people too quickly rather than working with them, coaching.
Okay, so we have an organization. We'll call it the fire organization. That is, you get hired, you need to produce. If you don't produce, you're out the door. Okay? All right? All right, that, let's...
It doesn't fit with the mission and values.
What's that?
It doesn't fit with the mission and values.
Disconnect. Yeah. Okay, disconnect. So practice is disconnected to what people in the organization believe are the values or the espoused values of the organization. Okay? Let's take a second example.
A new director of
part of the group comes in and wants to reshape the whole group according to their vision, but refuses to listen or see how that vision connects to the rest of the group.
Okay, so then we have the vision organization. That is maybe not the vision of the organization, but the vision of the person who fashions themselves to be the leader, and the leader therefore must have the vision. That paradigm. Okay, so we'll use those two over the course of the morning just to stimulate the conversation, and then you can dive into your specific issues. So, what we're going to talk about today is how to look at a problem. Because sometimes the problem becomes the leader not knowing how to look at the problem and understand it. We talked yesterday about one of the most important things a leader can do is actually figure out what the problem is, diagnose the problem, and then figure out how to frame the question for the organization to answer. And that becomes incredibly important. So, what we're going to do today is give you four frames, or like picture frames, four lenses through which you can examine a problem, and by doing so, probably cover most of the bases. All right? And those lenses are from the perspective of you as part of a factory, you as part of a family, you as part of a jungle, or you as part of a temple. All right, so these are four metaphors to guide how to take a look at a problem. All right, so the first area, well, let me back up. It is, you know, some questions about problems. What are problems? And problems are often the result of things being ambiguous. Organizations run into problems. Oftentimes, they're due to ambiguity in it. It's likely one of these sources. First is, you're not sure what the problem is. So the organization is divided over what the problem is. Or, we're not sure as an organization what's really happening. Something's happening, but we don't really know what it is. But we know something's happening. Or we're not sure what we want. So there's disagreement about what we want in the organization. Or we don't have the resources we need. And so there are arguments and fights about resources. Or we're not sure who is supposed to do what. And so that creates ambiguity. We're not sure how to get what we want. Disagreements about tactics or strategies. Or we're not sure how to determine if we have succeeded. We really aren't clear about the outcomes that we want at the end of the process. So these kinds of things happen in organizations, and they cause them to flounder because there's a lack of clarity. Folks are dealing with ambiguity. All right, so the Bowman and Deal approach then is to reframe. That is, to take what might be your customary way of looking at a problem, and each of you has a dominant way of conceiving a problem and understanding a problem, because each of us is operating with a mental model, right? You've constructed a mental model to make sense of the world. And so you immediately jump to that model, and you see if whatever you're trying to analyze fits into it, and then you draw a conclusion. And it is how you have gotten to be where you are in the world. You have found things that you've put in your toolbox, and they are there, and that is your model. If you've read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that, but he talks about leaders who are able to make snap judgments, these intuitive things that are extraordinary, how without analysis there's an intuition about how to respond. And that often has to do with the mental model that individual is using, and they can jump into their model, analyze it within seconds, and say, here's where we go, and oftentimes be right. So, this mental model that they put forward is one that starts to get you thinking in these four frames, or looking through the problem through all four lenses. And so what I hope will end up today is to give you a new mental model. So when you leave and you start taking problems at work or school or church and looking at them, you suddenly are thinking in a new way. And I can say for myself personally, it's completely changed the way I deal with problems and deal with my own blind spots. So the first is the factory. Bowman and Deal call the factory metaphor the structural frame. All right, the structural frame. So what do you think they're referring to as a structural frame? What would be the dynamics of structure in an organization?
An org chart.
Okay, an org chart.
You know, that kind of...
Who reports to who? What are the duties and responsibilities for each person? So it's clear, I do this and you do that, and then we report to this person, and they report and all of that. So that model of organization. What's another element of structure?
Budgeting.
Resources, resource allocations, budget, so how all the resources are spent. Very clear and hierarchical. Okay, yep.
A possible product, I mean, a bunch of stuff comes in here and it goes out over here as something else.
All right, so a clearly understood set of outcomes and goals, right, the product, but it's very clear, this is what we're doing. We're here because we're creating widgets, and you do this, and you do this, and when it all adds up, we have that.
If something is not going well, you look for the persons who aren't playing the right role within the factory.
All right, so...
Replacement people would then allow it to run smoothly.
All right, so that the problem might be that you've got the wrong person for the job description. Mm-hmm.
Human resources would be a broad way to say that? Or?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, but it's not quite, I wouldn't use that language, so I'm going to pick that language up for something else in a minute. But it's job description and individual and making sure you've got the person to do the job description. You wouldn't think of changing the job description.
Right, right. The person would be wrong, not the job.
The person would be wrong.
Structural. Are they all things that can be put on paper or quantified? All right, by looking ahead at thinking of what the others might be, but...
For example?
No, all the things we talked about, as opposed to the spiritual or more, call it nebulous things. These are things that can be documented, measured. They're the org chart, they're the budgets, they're structural, they're
policies, they're procedures.
They're written down.
Okay. So in many organizations that are faced with problems, the leaders will jump to, we need to change the policy. Or the way in which we do things, we have to change the procedures. The problem is that there's a problem with the procedures. If we change the procedures, then everything will be corrected. If we change out this person and get the person for the job description, then the organization will work well. If we just reorg and we put a vice president here and these four people under them, that's going to solve the problem. All right, so that's a structural view. All right, with your problem, the one personally you're dealing with, will you take a couple minutes with your partner and just share a little bit of the structural dimensions?
Just one question.
Yes, sir.
Would structural also be a utilitarian way of going about things?
Unpack what you mean by utilitarian in your context.
Very much just simply means, ends, so that what you're trying to achieve is greatest good for greatest number.
I think that would be an intention using any one of these frames. It's more in the how. You get to the best solution for the end by looking at the organization, the policies, the procedures, the budgets, those sorts of things. That's your way to accomplish the change.
One more question. Is this more of along the lines of formal rather than informal? Or are we not going there?
I don't think we're in that mode today.
Okay.
I don't think authority, it certainly would be about authority as formal authority. That is, it would not take the view that there is such a thing that is important in any way as informal authority. That what gives you what you need to accomplish in the organization is getting the job descriptions right and making sure you have everything accounted for and everybody.
I guess that's why I tripped on formal. That it's because it's structural, written down, objective, it has a way of being a formal structure.
Yes.
Where everything kind of is nailed down, very few things are left to individual choice, supposedly, that sort of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if we take a second with your partner, just share, just looking at the structure, what part of the problem is related to the structural dimension? Right?
Okay.
What is it about structure that might be causing the problem?
Lack of
All right, I'd like to just do a little check-in here. Two questions came out of folks that were wrestling with this issue. The one is, can structure, is it a bad thing? Or is it is this structural, is this bad? Is it always bad? And there's no value judgment on any of these. These are all tools that you can use to understand and address a problem. So at times, people may use a structural strategy to actually address and solve a problem. Sometimes the problem is largely a structural problem. Where we get tripped up is, for many people, this is the only tool they have in the toolbox. And so we rearrange the chairs on the Titanic deck, because all we know how to do is, let's just reorganize. Let's write a new policy, let's do a new process. So that's the only tool that they've got in the toolbox. So no judgment on it. It's just your problem may be a structural problem. You may be able to solve it, but it may not be in that way. Yes?
When a person with a lot of formal authority, they might want to use the power card here and insert the rules and policies, and they haven't taken the time to get to know people or work relationally with people. So they have even less and less for informal authority because they alienate everyone and they just throw the power around. So
right.
It can work. It's efficient, but it can really work against.
You're going to have a good time as we work through this. This will, I think, be very clear to you once you get through the four frames, what's happening in your situation. All right, so how do we use structure to deal with Mr. Fire people? You rest? Yep. I'm sorry?
Fire it.
Job description versus how the person performs within the state of the job.
All right, so evaluation, ensuring that there is appropriate evaluation and that there's clear means for bringing people on, hiring and firing, and that you deal with probationary periods and progress reports so that people understand how they're doing and what they need to do so that they can correct over time, that there's transparency to the rules so everybody understands how we work and what happens when people get fired. So you can use those structures to make it less about one person's power or a few people's power and more to empower everybody by letting them know how it all works. How about Mr. Vision or Miss Vision? How do you deal with the person who says, I have a vision, line up?
Well, part of the structure that you're provided that the vision could be measured against is, and this is tough because some congregations don't do this at least, is mission statement, vision statement, objectives, the things that the congregation has stated as their values, the priorities, and how that vision fits with all of those stated values.
So what process would you recommend for getting at that issue? Is there a process?
Strategic plan, sort of an idea, or a near-term plan, a mid-term plan, and a long plan?
So maybe the church council gets together and says, we need to engage. We are clearly seeing conflicting values playing out in our organization. So let's engage in a process through which we establish and have a conversation that will address these things. And out of this, we need to come up with an articulated set of strategies, goals, objectives, core values. So there's a procedure then that the organization begins to go through to manage a conversation and to then work toward a goal. So that's language of structure used to pull a person who's trying to pull the organization in a different direction than where its values may be. Don.
One of the problems that I see here is that you have to, when we're dealing with a problem, we have to be at a level that we can have some effect, right?
Emotional. I mean,
you have an organization, and you know you're at a certain level, and a there are organizational problems that you may have some control over, but a new associate professor who comes into the organization may see some problems, but he doesn't have an ability to affect that problem. So in dealing with problems, don't you have to be at a level at which you have some control?
You're asking the question and framing it is within a structural mindset. When we get to the jungle, anything can happen. But here, absolutely, in the structural mode, that first year associate professor has no ability within the job description to affect the outcome. Let me take one more question. We're going to move into the next step.
Oh, I was just thinking about a congregational meeting I was at in a congregation that was talking about youth, and that was their vision. And at the congregational meeting, the person stood up and said, but our budget does not at all reflect that. It's all in music and worship. And that set off, from a quiet voice in the corner, a long discussion from the vision that the pastor had, and it didn't wash in the structural sense with the budget allocation, both personnel and financial. So they did have influence within the structure to raise that question.
Because they were persuasive.
Yes.
So they actually were able, beyond position, to use persuasion to grab power.
Yes.
And people right, but that, listen that, to that.
Yes.
Right.
It was persuasive.
Got to the point, to a level of, to the people who did have the ability to do something.
But it was a beautiful structural moment of, you don't have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there is a big difference between a church body and a faculty member. Can you imagine? But just the dynamic, the interpersonal dynamics are quite different. Let's jump over to the next one, which is that the second way or second frame you can use to examine the problem is from a family perspective. And here, I'll use the word human resource. All right. So this is to look at the human dimension of the problem. This is where structuralists can get tripped up. So if an organization is embarking on a particular strategy and the people in the organization feel like they aren't being consulted or valued in terms of what is playing out in the process, here are the things that happen. These are symptoms. If you see symptoms like this in your organization, you'll know that you've got a human resource problem to deal with. The first is that people start to withdraw. There's chronic absenteeism, or they quit. The second is they stay on the job, but they withdraw psychologically. They become indifferent, passive, apathetic. I'm just riding it out till I retire. Okay, I'm not gonna get on the radar screen. I'm gonna lay low. Or they resist by restricting output, by deception, by feathering their nest. Or direct sabotage. Right, so people are actively, either through passive-aggressive behaviors or absolute sabotage, trying to prevent you or the organization from doing what you want to try to do. They climb out of their job. They're looking. Every time they see a job posting, they try to move. They're trying to move through the organization. And you can, if you see patterns of that activity, okay, then that will show you that in that unit, you have a human resource problem. You know, I've got one unit where I within 6 months of getting there, I started watching all these people transferring over here. So you can see, especially if you're sitting in a senior role, you can tell where the problems are just by following what's happening in the HR department. Folks will form alliances, such as labor unions in some organizations, to redress a power imbalance. The same place that I heard people were transferring, or I saw that, the supervisor kept saying, I'm so worried there's a union going to come in. All right, so that dynamic, that's another red flag. And then finally, and sadly, the people that are in those positions teach their children that work is unrewarding and hopes for advancement are slim. So you can see in some particular industries in the United States where there are prevalent management models, these organizations deteriorate and deteriorate and deteriorate. I'm not necessarily pointing to Detroit, but there are, you know, because there is a kind of culture and way of working that people have lost all empowerment in the organization, so that begins to decline. All right, so how about you and your problem and your situation? Can you talk a little bit? Yes, do you have a question?
Well, I'm slightly confused about the family definition because, you should just give your example because I think immediately family systems when you put family, but that's not what I heard you describing.
No, I described a symptom, and I didn't actually take the next step, so just bear with me one more minute. Okay. So how do you deal with it? What are your strategies? What are your approaches? You need to be thinking about the problem in terms of what do the people in this organization need? Why are they here? What do they want personally as individuals from their engagement here? And are there ways that I, in my role, could address that need? What kind of relationships do people have with each other? Is there something we can do to make people feel that they have a relationship with one another, that they have a relationship with this organization? And so there's that sense of belonging. What can I do to make people belong and feel that they have a personal sense in what it is that we're doing? So those are the questions you have to ask as a leader in this frame. Is there something that can be done to change that? So people do feel like they're really part of something. They're part of a family and belong. That's where the metaphor comes from. Did that help at all?
Well, then that tells me it's very different from family systems theory because this is about work to get people to belong, and family systems theory assumes that you already belong to some dynamic relationships.
Right, yes. You've got bloodlines in a family. There's another thing going on there. I think here is to take the metaphor of family and translating it to the group to try to create bonds that aren't going to be, they aren't by virtue of your birth, but they're by virtue of wanting to be part of something in an emotional way.
Well, and in Steve's example, this is a small congregation that it has a very clear identity as a family, and that's actually getting in the way of them doing their mission.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So in the same way, you know, Don was using the dominant mode of structure to understand the organization, that's the mental model for what's going on and how you can't possibly address it. Your primary mental model, as you're describing it, is family. That is your primary way of, that's your primary lens. So the problem is that family's not going to solve it, right?
Okay.
So you keep working your way through the tools because each of these situations are oftentimes operating in a dominant mental model or dominant mode. So with that in mind, can you talk a little bit with your partner about what is the human dimension of this problem? And are there some potential strategies you might use that would get at the human dimension where there, if indeed you think that there's a deficit there? Okay, turn that over to you. Okay, let's just check in. Some ideas, perhaps, that came out of your conversation. Some things you might do. Any ideas that you were wrestling with? Things you might do in this situation that might come out of this human dimension?
We struggled with the notion that family sometimes are with long-time employees or long, small communities, that family sometimes gets in the way of the change that needs to take place. Are you going to fire that person? How are you not going to fire them, but maybe use those structural pieces to help them reframe their thinking?
All right, so that does become an issue when the dominant way and the dominant value is around family.
Yeah.
Then any change that you might make in the leadership role is going to be viewed.
I was reminded that a piece of what we sell in our ELCA congregations or our campuses like Gustavus is community and family. And that sometimes gets to be baggage that can weigh you down when you need to make some reframing paradigms.
Right, because you're carrying people that are competent.
Right.
But you're carrying them because you care about them, and to sever them would be an act of not caring, which runs counter to your values.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very common.
Yeah. We had that happen too. In our school, we had two firings, which is just unbelievable. You know, and it's really broken the trust. So we've been spending 4 years on structural, just trying to change it. Oh no! And then you're so excited at the beginning of the year. Yes, this new plan is going to work. And then, we've been doing some family stuff. This last year, we did some team building and stuff. Can't wait to hear about the other two because we're not in the right.
Your organization hasn't gone through the adaptive change because there's if two people got fired and there's a huge issue around trust in the organization, you got two sets of values on mm-hmm. working. And what you have to work at is the holding environment to work that out so that people can agree on how we need to hold one another accountable to a certain level or a certain standard and what that is. So there's hidden competing values here that haven't been identified and worked through.
So what you're saying is in that from yesterday is that the question has not properly been formed.
You don't know what the problem is yet. Mm-hmm. The problem's not been diagnosed.
But I like that because what that is really is we have this old model of the family and sort of letting things uncle-y go along.
Mom and pop operation.
And now we have the new postmodern parents who don't trust really, and they're wanting more structure, more perfection, accountability, and we have word odds. Mm-hmm.
Yep. In fact, you're pretty close there. Yeah. Family, accountability. Yeah. Okay? Now how are we gonna modernize?
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the issues that I see in a lot of churches that I've been part of is that there's often a family feeling and ethic that's very clearly identified, and under the surface, there's an awful lot of dysfunction, and no one wants to talk about that, and if I may make myself a little unpopular, it tends to also be associated with some of the Scandinavian and that, how do you talk about that in the congregation in order to solve problems?
Hey, us Germans will give you a run for your money.
What about those of us that have both blood?
there's a question there for that congregation. I mean, there's a question that the church council or the pastor could frame that would take that on and could allow for learning and adaptation to occur in the organization. Yours was a great example where there's this competing value about our sense and primary purpose of mission and our money in music. So is it for us or is it for those who need? And there again, if that's the problem, then there's a great question for the pastor to frame and let the church work that out. And in a minute, the jungle will come.
Yeah. In terms of the question, what do people need? I heard a presenter recently talking about different demographic groups, and she said that Gen Xers and the Generation Y, or whatever you want to call them, they're looking for opportunities to build capacity to be built up as and more educational opportunities, more opportunities to learn and grow and skills and knowledge or whatever. And so it gets back to rather than just seeing that the person is not right for the job description, if there's a commitment to the person, to build the person up, to mentor them, to coach them, to take time to build them up so that they, to help them succeed in that position, and not just say it's all up to them to produce or not produce them. I have a responsibility to them. The organization has a responsibility to them to help them succeed.
It's a perfect example of this family strategy in action. So some of the things are to do everything you can to keep people in the organization. That's demonstrating care, concern for the people. So, you know, if you get that person in your church who's the dissident, and the natural tendency of people in the congregation is to get that person out like a splinter in your flesh, all right, then part of your role is to keep that person in community and to find the ways to do that, even though the organization is going to try to push them out because they represent a dissident voice. So that's, again, that's an important leadership.
But would you say there's some discernment there, because there is a line between dissent and antagonists that are coming from a really unhealthy place where they're at, and are there really just to...
I'm talking about the dissident, not the pathological,
okay.
You know,
saboteur.
The provocateur, right? That's the that person,
right.
You want. There's a person who, out of their brokenness, will inflict great damage on other people as people. You know, it isn't that they have ideas that might be running counter. So that's very different, and that is absolutely discernment on behalf of the leadership. So some other things. You need to invest in people. You need to invest in them. You need to allow for professional development and mentoring. All those things add up. You need to reward them. I know I'm off into transactional leadership and contingent rewards, but you do need to reward people when they perform. You need to empower them. So that's the issue here, is that people don't feel empowered in this vision example, because somebody is saying, here's the vision, and everybody's saying, well, where are we? So you've got to empower people in getting involved in those visionary things. And I would argue an important part of that family aspect is to work actively on diversifying the group and working through issues of diversity so that you're navigating what it means to have multiple perspectives just for the health and vitality of the organization. Whereas you might think that the family actually means we need to get a bunch of people who believe what we believe. I would argue the reverse in order to strengthen the organization and to not address your blind spots. I need to move quickly on to the next, which is the jungle. This is the political frame. All right? This is the political frame. Now, I need to remind you, I said that I attach no value, good or bad, to any of these frames. And politics have become so jaded, we are so cynical about it, that we assume whenever you use the word political, it is bad. And I would argue that you need to use this frame to think about your problem. What would be in a political frame? What would be the issues politically in a problem? What might I mean by that?
Leverage and influence.
Okay, so leverage and influence. So the power dimension. Who's got the power in the situation?
And how are they using it?
How are they using it, and can I figure out how to leverage that power? Or can I get the power to get done what I want to get done? Is there a way to form a coalition of people in order to upset the inherent form of power that Mr. Fire has? Is there something, can I get this group and this group and this group together? And then can we go here and can we get that person to change? Because this isn't working. This isn't working. Can we use power? All right, so take a minute, talk through your situation, see if you can figure out where's the power. Is there a coalition I could build? Is there a way in which we could bring people together in order to get around these other dimensions. Okay, let me, I'm allowed to go 5 minutes early. You're waiting for the bus. So let me just check in on a couple things here. First, on the political dimension, you've got to remember that organizations are coalitions. Using that lens, you think about who are the coalitions in this organization, and what belief system does each coalition hold? Make sure you've diagnosed that, because you need to understand that dynamic before you get into, if you choose to operate in this frame, you're in the jungle. And so you just need to be prepared and understand that. I think the next thing is that the most important decisions that are made in this political dynamic is around where resources go. That most of a political dynamic in an organization is a lack of resources and conflict over who gets them. So that may be playing out in some of your situations, okay?
That's conflict over who gets them, or over who gets to be in charge of where they go?
It's conflict over who gets them.
Okay.
The arguments become about that, who gets to decide. But ultimately, it's who gets the resources. So if you've got a lot of conflict going on in your organization, open conflict, go right to the resources. That's your issue. And then you might want to work out a process that's consultative, or a task force or committee, or you might need to do in a political environment, you might need to bargain or negotiate, because that's how you often solve in a political dimension. How you solve the problem is to bring the coalitions to the table and conduct a negotiation and read getting to the yes and then go in, all right, and try to figure out how you're going to solve that. So that's if you're going to use a political strategy or political lens and understand it, that's what you want to do. Questions or comments on that before I get you to the last one? Okay, so the last dimension is the temple. And here, this is the symbolic frame. And many people, although I don't know in our environment that we would so much, because many of us are actively engaged in a place of meaning, but in many organizations, people are completely blind to this. And they can't understand why there's an eruption of, they do something and everybody says, foul! You know, you have violated our covenant with one another. It's because the person hasn't thought through how people in the organization will interpret what happened and what it meant. What did that mean? I'll just tell you a personal story quickly. I moved from the University of Colorado to Valparaiso University. So I moved from a primarily structural paradigm to a symbolic paradigm. And my first several months there, I couldn't understand what was happening, because people were coming in and having urgent meetings with me. And the meetings were about what people were going to do at my inauguration. Like there was a proposal to do something. And that proposal would cause enormous controversy. And so there was these huge discussions and committees arguing with each other and conflict. And I kept looking at it thinking, what are the scarce resources? And here it was the resources of meaning. And it wasn't until I said, well, okay, it's had a Missouri Synod pastor as the president for the past 75 years, and I'm an ELCA layman.
Ding, 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 ding.
But it took a while to understand the behaviors. And what was happening was a power struggle over meaning.
Was it they didn't know whether to crown you?
I'll give you an example. They wanted people, it's a deeply spiritual place. And they wanted people to offer prayers for the hope of the future of the university and to the president.
And at the end, when people were leaving, they wanted to have a fire pit outside of the chapel. And there would be people there, contemporary musicians, playing, "Let my prayers rise up like incense." And they would put this, and it would be on rice paper, and up it would go. A beautiful, symbolic meaning. Well, folks that were concerned about the new guy coming in not being a pastor said, "That is a pagan ritual." It's a pagan ritual. And that's the slippery slope.
Yeah.
All right.
Here we go. First
here
slide.
We go. You know, you're bringing the guy with the earring, and it's down here. So that was, you know, that was a lot of the dynamic at the institution, and it took a while in analyzing. I have a problem, but I don't know what it is.
By the way, welcome to Valcom.
Yeah. And
try to throw you in at the end of that.
What's that?
Throw you into the fire kind of
at the end.
That's right. That's daily. Yeah.
But it told me that to address the problem, the first thing I needed to make clear to everybody were my values. Because all these other things were, but until you did all of that, you know, I wasn't going to solve that by any change in policy.
Policy for the fire.
Yeah, right. This is what we, so there are things, this dynamic is so deep. It's in the culture of the institution, deep. There are shared stories that people have. And you, as a person maybe coming in new to the organization, if you don't know the culture, if you don't know the stories, if you don't listen for the stories people tell you over and over and over again and decode what they mean, you could be completely blind and say, "Let's do this." And then suddenly you have just violated something symbolically important to the institution. And many people who want to go to a new vision will do so without being cognizant of the stories that inform the culture of the organization. And so a desire to change will come up in great conflict in this world, which is the symbolic world. So many of you that operate as pastors in churches, you know, you know this. You can tell, you know immediately, if we do this, this is what's going to happen in the body. And there are many other folks that are operating in corporations or schools that may not, it's not as overt as it is in a church. But all of this is at work in all of those bodies. Yes?
I'm wondering if an example of the symbolic might be when my husband, who was presiding at Holy Communion, one Sunday early in our ministry at our congregation, finished drinking from the chalice, put it down, and later got word that that was totally inappropriate behavior. And this flies back into the ethnic. I'm thinking that there has to be, you know, it's either ethnic or pietistic. It could be ethnic, it could be pietistic, you know, kind of the Scandinavian teetotaling population of the congregation is rising up in horror at the pastor.
This is where values are. Values exist here in this perspective, and so people, and it's all invisible. Invisible and silent. You only know it when you violate it. But it is revealed in the stories people tell you. But there are things that the body takes completely for granted until you've done something that they think symbolizes something that is running counter to the culture and the values.
Every organization that I'm in that is in a kind of a family structure has the storytellers or the corporate memory who carry the past breaking of symbolism or breaking of values. And if those people, they're the gems in your community, and they're the ones that can advise, like a new leader, you know, as to those historical scenarios that, you know, so that if you're contemplating something, you'll have these wise elders that will say, you know,
take them to lunch.
We've had some experience, yeah.
Take them to lunch.
Well, the one I shared with you. In my first congregation, they came to me and they said, "We need to build walls in our Sunday school room in the basement of the church." I'm going, "Oh, okay." So they went through the process, and we were going to have a congregational meeting. Well, one lady stood up and said, I don't know why we need walls down there. We had 50 more kids than we got now. We didn't have any problem with kids back then. I knew we were dead.
Yeah.
Then one man got up and in 7 words changed the whole thing. I hate to disagree with my sister, but now that was a symbolic thing for me, but it was also a thing of she was being tied back to her world, wanting that world to carry through. And he, the brother, was aware of that world, but said, we're in a different world. And that's the only way we got the Sunday school rules.
Was it literally brother and sister?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So there's a whole other thing going on.
Yeah.
I just wanted to offer a couple more comments about this issue of stories. Some organizations are so lost in their stories that they can't change. So one of the challenges is that those stories drive, if you're really operating in this, our tradition has been this. And you can see that tradition is not going to sustain them long term. Then you've got to figure out how to take the values that are inherent and tell a new story in a way that is persuasive. So sometimes good leaders that are operating in this frame are great storytellers. They can take things that they're picking up and frame it in a way that people will say, oh, I never thought of it that way. And that is how you begin to affect change, really using meaning and using symbols. Sometimes you can add a new ritual, because rituals operate in here as well. And sometimes one of those rituals is a funeral for the old way, which can be a very important ritual that will align with this culture and address the symbolic and the need to grieve losing this so that you can then move to this. There are all sorts of things I think that you can do, but rituals, stories, ceremonies, talking about heroes, spending time with the organization, saying who are we and what do we value. You know, those of you that deal with core value exercises, that's operating here in that way. So, just yes.
Could you give an example of a funeral for, say, you had a congregation that had a story that was very important to them, and you're saying have a funeral?
Well, let's say yes. Go ahead.
I could give an example. Our congregation, we had to move, leave one building behind and go to another facility. Our last service of that congregation was basically, I mean, simply went around at all in all the different places, right? At the altar, the lectern, gave a prayer of thanksgiving at all, and finally at the building itself. And in this sense, at the dismissal, we all walked out of the building and basically said thanks be to God and goodbye. And it was a ritual of simply leaving that building behind. And when we moved into the new building, of course, then was the ritual of entering into a new place.
I'll give you a great example, and one that wouldn't relate to a church setting. We had a multicultural center for our students of color that was a building set apart on the very far end of campus, very dilapidated, all the wrong messages. And so we created in our new student union, which is a showplace, we created in the very core of the building a center for multicultural programs, in the core of the building. So it was a fundamental change symbolically. It said, diversity is at the heart of what we do. It's not peripheral, so that's the symbolic nature. Those students were thrilled to be in that space and mourned their sense of being set apart. And so we didn't understand that until we got to the middle of the semester. So when the students come back, we're going to have a farewell ceremony at the side of the old building to let it go. And then we're going to have a march into the heart of the campus. And so all these things that you can do symbolically, again, to let go of something that was very special, but at the same time say, we are going to be at the core of this campus and no longer on the margins. Yes, sir.
Sometimes these things are entirely spontaneous and anarchistic, and I've been part of the forestry factories at Rice Universities for 35 years, and forestry's going through a massive symbolic transformation. And when that happened, when I was at Berkeley, the undergraduate students and graduate students liberated the women's room and invited everyone in. There were flowers in the toilet and the basins, and all the senior faculty who were retiring and with the old ways joined in the celebration of going and drinking champagne in the women's room. And it was the same. We are changing.
Why am I not surprised?
Tell us something you wouldn't believe.
I need to be respectful of your time. So today we've looked at four tools, which I hope will be helpful to you as you go off in your good work and try to figure out how to affect change in whatever role you find yourselves. Tomorrow, I'm hoping that you will teach me. And what I'd like to explore tomorrow with you is a conversation about what ought the relationship be between our Christian perspective and stance and this concept of leadership, which is a concept of the world. And how, as Lutherans, how, as Christians, how, as individuals who study the text of the Bible, and how can we inform the study of leadership, and how might leadership inform our Christian faith and understanding? So that's a conversation that I will not walk in with answers, only questions. And we'll use the time together to see what we can learn. So thank you. God bless your day. See you tomorrow.